power of our diplomacy. Diplomacy.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really big deal.
The strength of our diplomacy.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
It does sound kind of fun.
I want to play this game so bad.
Deadline.
Happy summer, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Diplomacy Cast. Diplomacy Cast is a podcast about the board game Diplomacy. I'm Eric Mead. His name's Nathan Barnes.
It sure the hell is.
It sure the heck is. How you doing, Nathan? Happy summer.
You know what? It's summer in Seattle, so you know it almost is 70, so it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and
you know, it's like 100 degrees on the East Coast right now. You know
I know. And yeah. Already impossibly hot in this little studio / bedroom of mine. I know.
Oh, let's call it a studio.
Yeah. In today's episode, we have lots more emails from hot off the presses that we're really looking forward to reading. Our Power Play segment today, it's all about France.
France, good country.
Yeah, the only country.
Terrible people.
That anyone like. Oh, boy. Do you want to talk politics, or do you want to talk... How do you want to do
this? No, just French diplomacy players. They keep winning.
It drives me nuts. That is kind of bad about them. Yeah. And they're kind of, you know, French.
Yeah.
But, no, we're going to talk about the power of France.
Oh, good. No, I know about that.
Plays.
Perfect.
Yeah. Also, our interview guest today in our never-ending parade of hobby luminaries, yet another one, the irresistible Southern charm of Mr. David Hood.
You make him sound like late mid-morning DJ or something. Like, he has the smooth, dulcet tones.
He does have dulcet tones.
He does have dulcet tones.
You guys will see.
They're yeah, no, David Hood is kind of... He's a true gentleman. That's what I can say about him.
He is. If you have any questions, any feedback, please email us, press@diplomacycast.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Well, I have just a couple of miscellaneous things I want to cover here. Just this and that.
Do we have to do diplomacy, or is this just your is this just a therapy session?
Yeah. How are you, Nathan? How you been?
What's new? Well, I'll be asking the questions here.
No, I just asked you a question. You were out of town. How was your trip?
Oh, it was lovely. Thank you. I drove a lot. I'm back. I'm refreshed. I'm ready to. I was ready to talk about France, but apparently you have some things to unload.
Yeah, I got some stuff I got to get.
Okay.
Off
no
chest.
Hey, you know this is. Hey, everybody else wants to hear it. How are you?
Fine. We've gotten several emails the last couple of days telling us, hey, I can't get the newest episode on iTunes, and I know, and we're trying to figure that out.
It's nice that you say we as if I have anything to do with it.
I'm trying to, well, no, me and Peter are trying to figure that out.
Oh, okay.
Me and the web guy are trying to figure out why.
Because I'm not doing shit.
It'll be there eventually. Yeah, I couldn't help but notice. You did a nice, relaxing vacation.
I was doing great.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I'll just write back to all the emails and deal with all the web problems. It's totally cool. Don't even worry about it.
I'm not worried.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Actually
good.
Pretty. I feel burdenless at the moment.
I'm glad.
It's good.
I'm glad.
It's really good.
Can I get you anything?
Another glass of wine?
Yeah, definitely.
Perfect.
No problem.
Thank you, Garkin.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next thing. There's been... I feel like maybe we haven't been clear enough about explaining that little part of our website on the front where you actually can plug your event that's coming up. We're happy to do it for you.
But when we say happy, I think we just mean cut and paste.
Yeah, kind of. Just tell us actually what you want us to put on the site, because I've been getting a few requests that are like, hey, can you just let everyone know about that? Write us a little ad, write us a paragraph, give us a link to a website if that's what you want, let us know the date. Just
because we're going to screw it up. I guess that's really
that's
the long and short of it.
Copying and pasting is one thing that I'm good at.
We can do that.
Yeah.
We can, control C, control V. That's really the extent of our ability.
And by we, you mean me.
Yes.
Okay.
frankly, my abilities as well, clearly. But, we'll screw it up otherwise.
Yeah.
And,
So, as of this moment going forward, we will post as many little ads for as many little upcoming diplomacy-related things as you like right on the front page of our site. We'll even, maybe even announce them on the show, but we'll definitely put them on the website. But just let us know what you want there.
Yeah.
Okay. One other thing. Oh, guests.
Oh, I like guests.
Yeah, guests are good. Some of the feedback we've been getting, people are enjoying the guests that we've been getting, and which is great. There are more like them. We can just continue marching out awesome tournament player after awesome tournament player for months or years to come, honestly. And if we start to run out of them, we can start bringing the same ones that you've liked the best back again for additional episodes. If you want to hear from different types of diplomacy players, for example, online diplomacy players.
Or just players that just play face-to-face that we don't know.
Yeah, players that play face-to-face we don't know. People that, I mean, we don't go to every tournament. I know there's been some people that have been doing well at tournaments we haven't been to, that's an idea. But I guess we're to the point now where we're ready to take some suggestions from you guys as far as who you want to hear from, and we'll even take specific names of people you want to hear from if it's somebody that you think is important to the hobby, either, you know, in the online world that maybe we don't know, in Europe is a, you know, another thing, another sort of thing,
sure,
that we haven't tackled yet.
Yeah, just whatever you guys want to hear from. If you have a person you think we should be talking to, just drop us a line, tell us who it is, and we're going to incorporate it into themes starting with episode 8. We're going to get through all the countries, and then we have a lot of ideas on what themes we're going to do, but we're going to be, you know, integrating people in all over the place. So if you have an idea of somebody you want us to talk to, drop us a line.
Yeah, if especially from the world of online, because that we are getting a lot of requests for that.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right, that's all I had. I'm ready to go to hot off the press. We didn't get any emails changing the name of it.
Weird. Yeah. That's weird. I should have sent you an email. Yeah. I should have. Really should have sent you an email about that.
Coming up next, hot off the press. Our first email comes from Dave Simpson.
Oh, Dave Simpson.
Oh, you know Dave Simpson.
I do know Dave Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
I met him in Paris last year.
Ah, yes.
Good gentleman.
Yes,
or chap.
British player.
Or whatever they say in Britain.
Well, he called us chaps. He says hello, chaps, at the beginning of the email.
So, I wonder if he knows what chaps are.
You mean like when we say pants here? And
they're really, it well, it's just the front part of pants.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are chaps.
No, we're not talking about the same thing. I'm just going to read this email now.
Oh, good. Oh, is this from Dave Simpson? He's a good guy.
This is from Dave Simpson. Thanks. Thanks for the reset there. He writes, well, bravo, a podcast all about the game. Who'd have thought that would happen? I'm loving the show so far, and I've learned something from every episode, and I've laughed at something in every episode, which can't be bad.
I agree.
I agree also. Your enthusiasm for the game comes through loud and clear, and that helps me keep me motivated, too, so please keep up the good work.
Shit, high expectations.
Yeah, totally.
It's going to be awkward around episode 10.
Well, here comes the part that actually I wanted to read this. That was just the part where he tells us we're awesome, and that's great. And that next part is, after the Jim O'Kelly interview, I got back in touch with some guys who want to start something ad hoc in London, and there should be a game later on this month. If that takes off as well as the Weasels, that would be amazing. And then he goes on and tells he finishes that thought with, all in all, your podcast came along at just the right time.
So perfect.
Yeah.
And we're starting a revolution.
We are. I wanted to read that because, hey, that's one guy that went and called some friends and started playing face-to-face.
It's something that you can do, too.
It's something you can do, too. Yeah. Dave, if you're listening to this, and I hope that you are, send us an update. Let us know how the organizing is going.
And we can, I don't know, plug it.
Yeah.
Let's plug it.
Definitely.
Put a plug in.
Sure.
Who else we got?
This one comes from Josh, who's actually sent us several excellent emails now, and this finally we're getting around to putting one on the show. And thanks for all the emails you've sent, Josh. I'm going to come in about halfway through. He got some feedback for us on the tactical stuff that we were talking about with Turkey in the last episode.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll read that.
Sure.
He says a minor disagreement about the AT alliance. Well, as a general rule, the alliance is highly ineffective and impossible to draw 17-17, since both countries begin on the same side of the stalemate line. It is a much more effective alliance if a Western power is included for a three-way. It would be best to include England, since both countries work well with their distant ally, and England's fleets would help take out the coastal zones that are more difficult to take over by the two countries. Additionally, since the three-way is the most solid of the draw types, it's reasonable for the game to end in this fashion. The only drawback is that this becomes problematic in face-to-face games, but not unfathomable given that Austria certainly has grounds to communicate with England, and if the alliance is formed early on, it's a prospect that could be easily fitted into a traditional game. Let's talk that part first, and then he has some other vaguely related stuff.
Well, I mean, first of all, I just want to say it's not impossible, and I want to just be clear. It's not impossible to do 1717 AT. It's just a gigantic pain in the ass.
Well, it's silly. I mean,
it's contrived, but all 1717s are contrived.
No, there's some of them that are possible to force. You can have 1717s right along a stalemate line if you do it really carefully. Question of why put forth that much effort just to get a two-way draw when you're so close to a solo is another question.
You can set it up such that you can't do anything about it afterwards doesn't mean that it's not contrived.
It's carefully, or I don't know.
We're gonna get off topic there.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. But he is correct in that I guess I'd say a lot of games that I've seen will end in a somebody from the West, Austria, Turkey three-way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is a decently stable, if you're not going that far over the line, type of a thing, but...
Yeah, I generally agree. Like, you know, an EAT is fine.
Yeah.
Who doesn't like to eat?
Yeah, right. And when you're done with it, you ate. And it's the same alliance. Yes, indeed. The only part I do quibble with, I guess, is that if you sort of are setting out at the beginning of the game planning for that. I mean, it can actually be fun to do kind of like, let's pick three powers on the board and just secretly be allies from the beginning. But I think that there's always sort of a tacit assumption in those that Anne will race to the win. And failing the win, that's when we might start talking about it.
I think some people have that tacit assumption, some people do not.
There's tournament situations where three people might just go, hey,
absolutely,
a three-way does us all a lot of good in this tournament. And those, you know, the other four people on the board are free to complain about that. And, you know, it's kind of dirty if you're actually just setting out at the beginning of the game playing for a three-way. I think that'll get,
well, I don't know.
Some people will complain about that at a tournament, but you know,
are you just facing facts? I mean, isn't it just that all three of you are ahead of the, ahead of the curve and you all have an interest in keeping ahead. And just because you're being overt about it. Not really looking at it in the face and like coming to the same conclusion, is it really that different?
It's sort of an ethical question. Some people complain about it and some people won't. I think that's the one complaint that some people do have about it, is that if you're one of the four, that game's just not very much fun. You know, one of the four that they plan on eliminating. It can be frustrating because you can never convince one of those three guys to do anything differently. And so it can be... And I understand that, but at the same time, tournaments are what tournaments are. And if you're trying to win the tournament and a three-way will do you good, I guess I can't fault anybody for playing that.
Right, but there's a difference between like a three will do you good and a win will do you better.
Yeah.
So I mean that's a really good diplomacy player is probably always trying to win.
Yeah.
And you know there's several stages to it, right? There's like, oh yeah, I'll take that three way draw, unless you screw up.
Yeah, that's true. You know, sure. Why not solo if you can?
Oh, of course.
But still, being one of the four on that board is kind of a drag.
I've been on that board more times than I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Sure. No, absolutely. But getting back to Josh's question, like, I think, you know, as long as you're not running out to do an EAT from the beginning, I think it's perfectly stable.
It's absolutely, you know, yeah, it is.
Try and win, Josh. That's what
I'm
saying.
Yeah,
try
exactly.
And win.
Exactly. You might start with that as a plan. Like if you're Turkey and say,
sure,
hey,
let's just go with this
three-way arrangement with England on the other side or something, and then just gut Austria when the time is right.
Yeah.
And you know, that can be a path, but
definitely, I think it's an intermediate step rather than a full game strategy. Who else we got? We got some more, right? At least one more.
Yeah, I'm not going to read the rest of Josh's right now because we just took too long on that first half of it. That's all right. But anyway, thanks for the email. Keep sending them. We loved it. We got another one from a David, no last name given.
he says judgmentally.
No.
It's from David. David's a good guy.
David seems really cool.
He seems like a nice guy.
I'm just going to read a little bit of it here. He says, hello, my history teacher got me and my friends into diplomacy. That's a story we hear very often.
All the time. Yeah,
I feel like I'm the only one who didn't learn it from an AP history teacher originally. But yeah, now we're playing online at playdiplomacy.com. And I've realized I can be very paranoid in trusting my allies. He then goes on to tell a story of a specific game that he played, which I'm not going to read. But the upshot of it is that at some point, his ally basically ends up stabbing him because... David, David's ally stabs David because David was so worried about getting stabbed that his ally felt like he couldn't talk to him.
Essentially, he sent a lot of emails to his ally
saying, hey, I think you're going to stab me.
Right.
And that kind of led to his ally stabbing
him. Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy, as a great man once said.
Exactly. And then his question at the end of that is, I wonder, what do you guys think of how much we should trust what our allies say? It's a great question.
It's a huge question. It's a huge question.
Almost an impossible question to really answer. But
it is impossible simply because it really depends on your ally.
Yeah.
And in the medium of email makes it difficult because you don't have so much of what we use to gauge trustworthiness. You don't have facial expressions, you don't mm-hmm. have eye movement, you don't have, body movement, all that nonverbal stuff that just goes into these gut feelings you have about whether or not you want to trust someone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult online, which is why I'm having a little trouble with this question. So hopefully you have something.
Yeah, I got a couple of things. I think that on email, here's my thought on this. On email, you have to consider, you kind of have to look for the logic of what it is that they're saying. If your ally is selling you something, you kind of have to look at it from his perspective and say, is that really something that he'd want me to do? Or, in other words, figure out who's trying to give you false logic versus who's trying to give you real logic. Because the email game is a more kind of logic-based and less gut-based game.
Sure.
You have to kind of
look. You have all that time.
You have all that time, and you don't have the facial expression component of it. You don't have the human component of it.
Here's what I would say, and why people should play online games.
Mm.
This is why you should play at least a little while, do a stint doing online.
Yep.
Because what it forces you to do, this is exactly what you were saying, you really need to step into the other person's shoes.
Yeah.
Look at the game board, to look at the board from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Think about, okay, I'm now this other person. What do I really want to do?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Now that I really sit here and look at it, I really should be going this way. And then compare that to what they're selling you.
Right.
If it just seems like, wow, there's such a better move, and that better move is against, say, me,
mm-hmm.
you should really be a little bit more leery. I think that's the great thing about online play, because you have that time to really sit down and get in another person's shoes until it becomes like second nature.
Yep. Yep. I agree. And of course, now we got to talk about it from the face-to-face perspective, because that's actually what we know anything about.
we both did online stints, but yes, all goes back to the face-to-face.
Yeah. From the face-to-face perspective, I think, there is that sort of human element to it. You really just have to go with your gut sometimes and but of course your gut, as you get more experienced with the game, gets sort of guided by exactly what we just talked about.
Right.
You get in the habit of going, putting yourself in the other person's shoes and saying, why is he trying to convince me to do this? And I think especially in face-to-face games, the ability to convince people that you're telling the truth when you are telling the truth is probably more important than the ability to convince people that you're telling the truth when you're lying, because the former you're going to do a lot more often than the latter.
Ideally.
And everybody's paranoid in diplomacy.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. Everybody's trying, especially like in a tournament environment, everybody's trying to figure out, why is this guy trying to sell me on this? And one of the most important skills you can have is the ability to go, look, I'm trying to sell you on this because it's good for me and because it's good for you and because I really want to be your ally here, when you do mean it.
Right.
And
so you have some credibility when you come to the table, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I guess in face-to-face, part of it is when people aren't making that effort with you. I think one of the things that in a face-to-face game makes me go, ooh, I'm about to get stabbed here, is when they just go, oh yeah, so I'm just going to move to Bulgaria. And they don't really take that moment to say, I'm going to move to Bulgaria because, I want to keep this alliance going, because I want to, just continue trying to make the effort to convince me that they're telling the truth when they're telling the truth. And when they're not doing that, that's when I tend to get a little bit suspicious, which is, I think, maybe why I just have hard times with alliances with some players, because,
Well, the last thing I want to say about this question,
yeah.
he specifically says, how much should I trust with the my ally say? And this is just a little like trick that you can do. Anybody can do this in any diplomacy game anytime. You want to do this kind of early. Go to people that you are going to be neighbors with, that you anticipate that you're going to be working with for a really, really long time. And set up situations in which they're given the opportunity to lie to you. And just see what happens. You know, give you know, especially in situations where it just doesn't really matter what they do. But just say, hey, I'd really like it if you didn't go to pick random place here.
Yeah.
Please don't go to Vienna this turn. Or whatever it is that you want to do. And it might be in part of your, you know, maybe it's advancing your overall strategy. Maybe you have an EF and you're saying, I think the EF should go like this. Just set up opportunities really early in the game where it's often less critical. Figure out how that person acts.
Is he just going to always tell you what you want to hear? Or is he going to tell you, no, I actually am going to go to Vienna this turn, and here's why?
On email, does he send you a short email? Does he send you a long email?
Yep.
Is he really, you know, and what happens after that? And look for those patterns. Like, because it just turns out people tend to do the same thing over and over and over again, and it's pretty easy once you identify, like, oh, when he's lying, he sends me three sentences, and when he's going to tell the truth, he sends me three pages. Go with
that. Right. And I mean, I think this is the kind of stuff that we're going to get into a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're doing these sort of first seven really strategy-heavy episodes, but we're looking forward to getting into some more diplomacy-heavy subjects down the line. As you can see, we've already run this segment forever because it was an interesting question, and we got all excited talking about how to read people and stuff. And so there will be more of this to come.
Sure.
But thanks for the email, Dave.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
And then one just awesome one that I had to read at the end. Our friend Christian Padone sent us this. It just reads, Eric and Nathan, fact, I listened to your England and Russia podcasts on the drive from Philly to Chapel Hill. Fact, I won both Best England and Best Russia at DixieCon. Coincidence? Perhaps. Perhaps not. Keep up the solid work.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
No, I don't think so either.
Seriously, for those two ones, those are our better ones. I mean...
Yeah.
We've some good tips there.
I have nothing to add, really. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks for the shout out.
Now, thanks a lot, man. We're going on to Power Plays.
Power Plays.
Power Plays.
Power Plays.
Okay, our Power Play segment today is all about the country of France.
Yes, French.
Everybody's favorite. Right? Well, not everybody's, but...
I think it's a favorite.
It's definitely a favorite. It's one of the ones that we're not going to start this segment with. Well, you're bummed out because you just drew this.
Yeah, no, you're elated.
Yeah, usually you're happy, although, I don't know.
I'm sure there's somebody that's like, oh, I hate France.
I've been having some mediocre Frances lately.
Well, just because it's mediocre doesn't mean it's a bad country.
That's true. There's a lot of good to be said for France. It's got sort of a solid, kind of hard-to-budge position. It's got easy growth very nearby.
Yeah.
It's got the solo possibilities in that it's, you know, it's got some spots that are pretty close to the stalemate line.
It's a great solid country, well fortified, well positioned. It has easy access to both sides of the line.
Yep.
It's a great country.
I think probably if we were to even talk about a weakness of it, we'd have to say that the weakness of it is that everybody knows that it's a good country. And so people tend to react, or at least they should react and overreact to just the existence of France, and people, I think, worry a lot more if France's have good start.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a three-build France is a huge deal.
Yeah. We'll cover the specific builds in the specific early years early, but just I'd say even, not even in 1901, but I'd say for a couple of years after that, you know, people overreact to France's that are doing too well.
Right.
And
they're hard to get rid of.
Yeah. They are hard to get rid of.
And at the same time, and I want to say... for all you people out there that I know are busily organizing house games, this is a great country to put someone who's brand new at the game in.
That's true.
Just stick them there, and they'll be good for a while, because it's really difficult to get rid of them.
That's true.
There's enough room to play around. You're not stuck in a box like Turkey.
Yeah, and you yourself, you experience diplomacy player should probably play like Germany if you're going to put like another newbie in England or something.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a bad way. If you set the board.
Yeah.
You know, if you just draw it out of the hat. A lot of times what we'll do with these house games, not to get too far down a tangent, but a lot of times if we'll draw it out of the hat, and if I happen to notice that I drew France and the newbie drew Italy or Austria or something, I'll just go, hey, we can trade.
Yeah.
Don't make a big deal out of it. But yeah.
It gives you a lot of... You get to move around a little bit.
Yeah.
So definitely. Anyway, that's France.
Yep. Okay, so let's kind of do our go-around-the-board thing that we seem to do every time. Talk about your neighbors when you're France, sort of your plan early on when you're France.
Well, let's start with Germany.
Okay.
You're really, you know, let's be all World War II-y, World War I-y about it.
Yep.
You know, you're concerned about whether or not Munich's going to be pushing over that line.
True.
You need to be talking about the lowlands with them.
Mm-hmm.
They generally have some interest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you usually think about with?
Yeah. With Germany, I mean, obviously I'm doing that thing that you kind of end up doing in the West, which is you try and figure out, well, there's two immediate neighbors and I'd rather be in the 2-on-1 than the 1-on-2. And so right. I'm trying to figure out which of the two of them I can work with best. And so if I want to work with Germany, then obviously the first thing I'm talking about with them is Burgundy.
Right.
Because all right, but backing up for just a sec, what you really want to do with France under any circumstances is kind of be left alone for a year, right?
Oh, yeah.
The unique positioning of France in terms of those neutrals that are admittedly sort of out of the way, you have to kind of schlep over and get Spain and Portugal, but no one else is going to contest them, and so you should just kind of go get those most of the time.
Right.
So if I want to work with Germany, I'm still trying to figure out, you know, is that still my main goal? Am I still going to try and get over to Portugal, Spain right away, or how aggressive does this German want to be?
Right, that's what you're trying to figure. I mean, I think like you're really trying to figure out, okay, is this one of two things? If the Germany is going to be so aggressive that I have to devote more than one unit to defending the line, or is this Germany is going to be so non-aggressive that I can easily go and swoop up those other two neutrals in Spain and Portugal?
Exactly.
That's really what you're trying to
determine. Exactly. With a German that you just feel real, real good about right away,
yeah,
that you don't think Burgundy's an issue, you can certainly kind of just open up to, say, Picardy or something, give yourself a little bit of influence over Belgium, and then still get your neutrals with no problem.
Sure.
There are some people who will argue that even if you do like your German and intend to work with your German, that you should probably still go to Burgundy because it's just your space and there's not much downside to doing it.
Some of those people might be here.
Yeah, some of those people might be you.
Just hypothetically speaking, they could be in this studio.
Doug Moore actually is one of those people.
Yeah, I'm sure he is.
He mentioned it last week on our show.
That's why I knew.
Yeah, he said he just pretty much always does that, and I know you kind of agree with that. Yeah. But of course, not every German is the kind of player who's, you know, there's some people who will just be like, you supported yourself into Burgundy, that's a declaration of war.
Well, sure, absolutely. But at the same time, like, just to take it to another neighbor over here, if England is opening to the channel, I'm probably not screwing around with, you know, supporting myself into Burgundy. I mean, it's all board specific.
Obviously. But I guess the point is, if you want to work with the German, I don't know. I get that that's probably France's best opening to just support himself into Burgundy, but some Germanys aren't going to take it the right way, and so under some circumstances, you just shouldn't do that if you want to remain friendly with your German.
Sure, but this is the last thing we were going to say about this.
Yeah.
I almost always tell the German I'm doing it.
Yeah, oh,
so,
I know.
So, I mean, at that point, they can totally freak out, and I can make a decision then.
And what are your results in those circumstances? Do you find yourself at war with Germany a lot? Or?
No, not really.
Okay. Yeah, but maybe I should. I've definitely done that before. I've definitely said.
I think as long as you tell them,
especially if it's a kind of a, I don't want to say softer, but kind of just like a newer player who doesn't really, you know, if you can kind of sell the, oh, this is just always what I do, and not have anyone be mad at you for saying that, then
sure,
it's fine because it is a pretty powerful move. Definitely.
Well, it's one less thing to worry about. It's very defensive. I agree with that.
Now,
it goes against my cowboy nature, but
yeah. Now, to take that a step further, though, if you want to do a just totally on board with Germany thing, there are, and I think we've alluded to them in previous shows, there are some sort of gambits where you go grab the channel right away, you move up to Picardy or something like that, and then you plan on supporting the German into the North Sea in the fall, and you can just surround the English guy. But, you know, again, this is one of those things where you have to just...
You gotta know.
Gotta know him, gotta be convinced that that's what the guy wants to do. It's effective stuff, if that's what you want to do. So, an FG alliance has a lot of options, but they also have that just nervous...
It's a timing thing. Like, are so much more powerful if you can get out of the gate, but it's so difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And really it's good for France to do that, you know, to just be like, okay, let's just go dig out England right now, and let's just do it as quick as we possibly can. Right. That's great.
But at the same time, I think that the philosophy that you distilled in early in this segment, you just want to be left alone. Mm-hmm. Like, ideally, if you don't know what's going on, you know nobody, you don't know anything, you just got to get to O2, and you're so golden.
Nobody ever minds when you're France and you say, I just want to get my neutrals.
No one actually, for whatever reason.
And then they say, well, what about Belgium? And you go, no, I don't really want it. I just want my neutrals.
Yeah.
People are usually sort of relieved by that. They shouldn't be.
I know they shouldn't be. It's ridiculous. They should be like, no, screw you.
Yeah.
I'm angry about that. You get to pick up two. I'm scrambling to get Norway, dying of fire.
And then you get to pick who gets Belgium at the end of it.
Right. Exactly. It's like, what a jerk.
But that's what Francis do, and it's amazing how often that works. You know, just leave me alone for a year and let me grow, please. And people just go, oh, okay. So then moving on to England then, because I think that sort of tails into France's that are just going to get their neutrals are definitely doing so because they at least think they have the tacit approval.
They don't have the threat.
Right, exactly. So, they want to go to the Mid-Atlantic Ocean because that's the easiest way to get both of those neutrals. They want to go... It's not the only way, but yeah,
it's the easiest way.
It's the easiest way.
It takes the less... You leave your armies up on in the...
Anywhere but stuffed so far up into Iberia that they'll never be any use to.
Exactly. Yeah. Yay! Army Portugal!
Yeah, exactly. We talked a lot about the channel in the England episode. It's obviously... What we said about it in the England episode was mostly that France doesn't really want to go there most of the time.
And it's some stupid amount of time that they go there. It's some small percentage of the time. Yeah. It's hard to trust the German enough to do it, and you don't want to do it by yourself. And if you can just get away with getting to O2 without someone, you know, cramming up your ass, you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And so you have to sort of feel the English guy out right away, obviously, when you're France, and just say, well... You know, does he just want to get his standard things too? Is he trying to sell me on a let's go kill Germany alliance? What's he doing?
Or you're trying to sell him on it because ideally that's what you're selling.
It's like, not about, but you
well,
know.
It's easiest for you. It keeps him off. It keeps him off of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably doing stuff defensively with Germany anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter which way you ultimately choose to go, it all looks on the up and up.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You're usually trying to pitch the EF.
Exactly. So it keeps it, in other words, because it keeps him out of the channel.
Right.
It lets you go to the Mid-Atlantic and go get your neutrals, which is what you really want to do. It gives you something that you could conceivably do about Belgium. Like, you can sort of plan together with him. And if he ends up there, it's because you wanted him there.
Yeah.
For example. And I guess we got to get to eventually the best thing that can happen early on is France is when somebody wants to give you Belgium. And in that case, usually you don't say, I'm going to build three.
Yeah, please don't do
that. People freak out when France is build three, and they should almost never do it unless you're just on a board full of people that don't know that they should freak out about that.
Or you're on the board where you're just going to get eaten alive and you need every little bit you can. But
right?
I mean, there's a time and a place, but ideally, you're skipping one of those Iberians.
Which is beautiful, because then, for whatever reason, if people don't worry enough about that. They say, all right, France is getting Belgium, but he's going to do something cute and not take both Spain and Portugal for some reason. But then you're only building two, and for whatever reason, they're relieved because they're suckers.
I guess
the best thing that can happen to France is to take only one of the two Iberians and take Belgium.
Just leave Portugal hanging out,
or Spain. You know, get it on the way back. Either way,
just push right through the Western Med. Why not?
Yeah. But because then you're only building two, and people are like, okay, France built two. He always builds two. But then people say, well, yeah, but then you just have this extra dot, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think they forget.
They forget, yeah, exactly. Oh, Spain's unowned, huh? And then they go about their business and don't really think about that. And who else is ever going to take Spain? It's you. So really, you are doing three builds. You're just doing them over 2 years and not spooking the board. And so if you can ever engineer any kind of a circumstance where somebody's okay with you getting Belgium, And the price is you have to say, oh, I just won't take one of the Iberians so that I only build two.
Just
bye, because the
it doesn't
scare people as much as it should, and it's almost the same as building three.
And if you're lucky, don't take it the next year. Don't take it the next year. Don't take it the next year.
Yeah, right.
Take it when you need it.
Right.
When it's like, oh, I need to stab my ally now, and blink, I build two.
Or three,
or however many you build at that point.
Exactly. I've definitely had Frances that have just not gotten around to one of the Iberians for a while, and it's always because they're doing so good.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Without question. Excuse me. Anything else about England?
No. Let's get over to the other side of the board. Well, or the other side of the board, I guess, Italy.
Yeah, well, it's technically on the other side of the board, but there's this little handy land, you know, you're not that far from Italy,
no,
I guess is what I'm trying to say. They are on the other side of the board, and there's Switzerland sort of in the way. But they're going to be important to your early plans. For one thing, they can ruin your early plans. Let's start with that.
Once in a while, those Italians, they just decide, oh, I'm going to go to Piedmont, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've listened to the, you know, episode, I think, four, where we talk about Italy, you know my opinion on it. Like, I think it's a bad way to go for Italy, but...
And my opinion is that it can be fun sometimes, just don't plan on actually conquering France.
Just pushing over there in 01, just like knocking on Marseille, like, hi, how you doing? Mm-hmm. They could be there, especially if they've gotten in some effort with between England and Germany and doing some sort of, you know...
Yeah.
Sea lion.
Jump on France.
Not sea lion.
Yeah. Just a,
Churchill, I think I call it.
And everybody jump on France is what I would call it.
Well, you like more words.
Yes. Yes, I do. That's definitely something to consider is every once in a while in Italy just wants to go to Piedmont and you should convince him not to. You're gonna have to have that conversation. If you feel like, or you hear through the grapevine that no. For those of you at home, Nathan almost poured a glass of wine into my Coca-Cola, which really would have been delicious. But
they drink that in Argentina.
They drink that at Michael Jackson's house, I hear, too.
He's dead.
Oh, goodbye, Michael Jackson.
Cheers.
Yeah.
I'm actually pouring this terrible wine out on Eric's carpet right now, just in memory of Michael Jackson.
Thanks. Thanks for that. Anyway, the Italian going to Piedmont. That was so terribly distracting.
Who was related to the Argentinians who believe they're Italian. This is all actually part of the thread.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You need to watch out for the Italian.
Right here in the show notes. Pour wine in Coca-Cola. There it is.
It all makes sense.
Yeah.
But other than that, really, you don't really need to talk. Here's what I do.
Yeah.
I generally go to the Italian and say, hey, look, you know what? I don't really want to mess with you. I don't think you really want to mess with me. Let's just go our separate ways.
Yeah.
Because, honestly, I believe the Italians should go the other way, and I believe that my strength, my early game is in the West. Really, it works out pretty well.
It's true, and it is actually amazing when you can just make long-term peace with Italy.
Yeah.
It's really good for both countries, usually. If for some reason you can just look into each other's eyes and just say, hey, you stay on your side, I'll stay on my side, and then, like, it gets, as the game progresses, if you really are both doing well, as the game progresses, it gets a little tenser every year. It's sort of just...
Because sooner or later...
Like, yeah, someone's like, you're still staying on your side? You see, you're still staying on your side? Because there's going to be fleets all over the place.
Yeah.
But you're staying, you know, and obviously your side, when I say that, the French player should be thinking nothing south of Gibraltar. And the Italian player should be thinking nothing west of, I guess, the Tyrrhenian at worst.
Yeah.
Although I've had French players even be mad about that before when I'm Italy. And which I think is just greedy. But
yeah, it's greedy.
But obviously there's going to be that tension, and the tension comes from the fact that it's one of those mid-game tensions that comes from the fact that most Frances that are doing well come after Italy next, and most Italy's that are doing well come after France next. Yeah. And you don't want to be second into the mid if they're coming anyway. And so that's always your early thing. I mean, your early thing that you're talking about with Italy is really just Piedmont. But what you're thinking early is are we going to do this? You know, are we going to manage to stay out of each other's ways? And of course you always say, oh yeah, I'm going to stay out of your way and you're going to stay out of my way. But,
well, I think there's a tacit 5-year sort of thing on that, but yeah. I guess not everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the Italy is I guess to be feared when you're France.
Especially in that 0-1 move. Mm-hmm. If you can get past that, you're probably fine. I mean,
that's really what you're at?
No, I mean if you really, like, your first primary goal is I need to get to fall without the Italian in Piedmont. Okay.
Without the Italian in Piedmont, without the French, or without the German guy in Burgundy, and without the English guy in the English Channel. I guess that's...
Right. I was talking specifically about Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you're just trying to get past that first season. And then after that, you're trying to get, like, a 4-year sort of armistice.
Right.
And then, at that point, hopefully, you've won out in the West, and then you can go pummel him.
Sure.
Would be ideal.
Sure.
Or you somehow have an FI, which never, ever happens.
Well, they can certainly sort of form in the mid-game if you stayed out of your
each
other's way until then. You can just, you know,
if you guys went get army a little heavy or something.
Yeah, you can. Well, and I've even had games, I guess. You know, if the Italian does want to go up to Tyrolia and put a little pressure on the German, then you can always, if you were anti-German anyway, it gives you the option of supporting him up to Munich.
If your Italian is dumb enough to do that.
If he's game, you know, and Lord knows I've been talked into it before, and it's...
Hey, Italy's, don't ever do that.
Yeah, but we're doing a France episode,
please,
so
don't do that.
Hey, France's, try and convince Italians to do that, you know? It's, if you're in Burgundy, and you're able to convince the Italian dude to do that, you know, it's actually, I'd write the order a lot of the time.
Oh yeah. Sure. Yes, France, I totally agree.
Yeah. So
what else we've got 3 powers left, right? Who else do we need to talk to?
So then there's Austria, and the thing I suppose that you talk to Austria about the most is what's going on with the Italian. You know, you're trying to figure out, is the Italian coming after me? He's trying to figure out, is the Italian coming after me? And so I guess you probably talk to the Austrian and say, hey, let's try and send him after Turkey. Because,
sure,
and it depends on your disposition toward Austria. Like, if you don't really care, then...
But it's not somebody you're spending a lot of time talking to. You're spending, like, a minute.
Although I guess you don't probably want to see him jumped by the Italian most of the time, because then the Italian gets bigger faster, and that's usually not good for you. Mm. When you're French.
But so, I mean, it's not something you're talking to the Italian about, though.
Well, right? unless Italy just comes right up to you and says, oh, don't worry, I'm not coming after you because I'm going to jump right into Austria.
Of course, at that
point, you might go to Austria and say, hey, cover Trieste there, buddy.
Yeah, no, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I can't wait for that episode where we talk about that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We got 2 more countries left. Russia, you don't really talk about too much other than you do the, like, let's have a long-term... Well,
I'll say a couple things about Russia-Turkey.
Interesting. You're right.
The Russian, and I said the same thing when we did the Russia episode, Russia and France are really natural friends.
Yeah.
They hate the same thing, which is an EG, for one thing.
Okay.
And so they need to constantly be talking about making sure that doesn't happen. I feel like usually when I play France, I can just go and sort of tell as much truth as I want to most Russian players and hope that they do the same for me, because they're good at swapping what's going to happen. The other thing is, the French player doesn't actually really mind a juggernaut, unlike almost everybody else on the board.
No, he has no problem.
Mine's an RT. It's actually not bad for France, because a juggernaut puts pressure on literally everybody that France has to deal with early on.
I think actually literally the whole board except France.
Right. He's the one that doesn't mind it. And I've certainly seen a lot of games end in Russia, Turkey, France draws. Yeah. You know, obviously that's not your goal, but still putting anything that puts pressure on all your neighbors isn't bad for you. So Russians generally can feel free to tell you the truth about the existence or non-existence of a juggernaut if they're trying to like hide it from everyone else. And so, and it's even something that you might kind of try and distract other people from and kind of let it happen. And that's not a bad way to approach it. Turkey, kind of the same thing when you're interacting with Turkey. But I guess with Turkey, you're also talking specifically about, hey, let's send Italy at Austria. You know, whole Italy's got to be going after someone and everybody just doesn't want it.
There's
to
a little bit more to talk about with Russia in that maybe you have some sort of England angle that you're trying to suss out.
Oh, true. I mean, if you're going to do an everybody pile on England thing anyway, you should probably try and solicit Russian help.
Well, that would be part of the everybody,
Yeah, exactly. Russia is a really important part of that everybody, if that's your plan, France. Sure. Getting some Russian northern involvement to keep him off Scandinavia as much as possible is big. It's real big. In fact, it takes it from slog to easy.
Yeah, it takes it into an efficient surgical removal of what we're going to call a cancer that is
England polyp.
Exactly.
Which I mean, all right, let's just go real quick into that. Longer term, is it healthier for France to try? I mean, who do you prefer to go after? I guess let's get into that.
You want to go there, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've successfully navigated our first year. We don't have we're not hurting, and we've probably ideally as France, you've tried to cultivate an EF and an FG. You've tried to do both, whichever one's stuck is the one you're probably going to go with.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say both are amenable, and I have my choice.
Yeah, and just leaving just for the tactical reasons, leaving the which player you're enjoying working with more out of it.
Honestly, I would. Oh man, it's really tough.
It is tough.
I mean, there's a huge part of me that wants to just eliminate England as quickly as possible because I know I'm going to get the lion's share of that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Germany is so difficult to if they get their dander up, they can just lock down that Belgium, Ruhr, Munich line. Sure. I mean, it's tough to get around that.
It's an unpleasant army war even from the beginning.
Yeah. So if you another part of me is like, oh, if we can take out Germany, that might be ideal. Probably what ends up happening most often for me is that I kind of go halfway. I usually pick one, take half of them down, switch sides.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think you're really trying to you're really trying to dominate entirely the West. Like, that's really what you want to do here.
Oh, for sure. And I guess the one thing I have to add to that is when you are conquering big chunks of England, that my experience is that when it's finally done or almost done, you end up with just like so many units that you've put up there that are so far away from anywhere else.
Yeah,
that's true. You know, you've probably got somebody up in Clyde and somebody back in the North Atlantic and all these spots that you needed in order to take England all the way down. It can be a while before you can reshuffle to anywhere.
It's risky. Yeah, I can see that.
Having said that, sometimes you can just steer those things right at Germany afterwards and have a great stab, depending on how well he did and how extended he is.
Well, I think that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, you're out of place, but you're hopefully building enough units. Like, you pick up at least two off the mainland of England. You've probably taken Belgium from England or whatever they had.
Yeah.
And Germany ends up with, two.
Yeah, that's true. He's probably, gotten some Scandinavia or something.
Yeah.
And honestly, that can work long term.
Mm-hmm.
If you decide you don't want to stab your
German guy afterwards,
it'll take a little while to swing around and start going after Italy, which is what you're doing next if you're not stabbing Germany.
Right.
But it's doable.
Especially if you pop some units or something.
Yeah, definitely. And if you can do it, well, and especially if you can sort of DMZ those lowland areas and that kind of thing. But if you can pull that off, then that alliance can last a long time. Now, England-France can last a long time, too.
Oh, yeah. Really long time. It's nicely divided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they stay up north. They eventually sort of run out.
Yeah.
I think before you do, which well, I guess
because
is
generally Russia, you know, the Russian area gets capped, you know, because it's such an easy, you know, stalemate there.
God, it's yet another really good thing about France now that we're breaking this down is that both of their most obvious early alliances can be long-term alliances that can take them really far if they're so inclined.
And they both are their partner ends up being naturally limited, whereas you naturally are not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's ridiculous. No, exactly. France is a stupid powerhouse country. It's it's retarded.
Mm-hmm. Well. I mean, which is not to say that it's always going to get the better of
smacked down as France.
Which is another thing that I suppose we should be sort of drifting into is, okay, we've talked about what's great about getting either of those allies as an ally. What do you do when you're getting jumped early on?
Well, here's the first thing I want to say. And I don't know if you set me up for this on purpose, but... I just want to say this to everyone who's ever going to play France, just in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got France, and you've got your builds, and it's 1901. It's you know winter 1901, just about to be 1902. Build a fleet.
Oh yeah.
Please build a fleet. I know Germany's attacking you. I know you want to build more armies.
Or you're attacking Germany. I think that's where I see it happen the most.
Or whatever it is. For all that is holy,
yeah.
For the good of the order, please build a fleet. It literally will break the game if you do not build a fleet.
I don't know that I'd go that far, but it's important.
It is more than important. The whole game suddenly just shifts.
Yeah.
Like, Italy suddenly is like, well, I guess I could peel off what I was actually doing and head that way.
And England.
England's like, wow, you only have one fleet? Wow, this looks delicious.
Yeah.
And there's no balance. It like takes all balance out of the game. I've seen so many games just sort of crumble.
All those spots, sort of mid-Atlantic, English Channel, even like Gulf of Lyon, West Med. Those you do need to be thinking of those as your water.
And
not like you always have to have a piece in all of those spaces or anything. But if you don't sort of give a credible reason to anyone why they can't just occupy that water, they'll just occupy that water.
Well, yeah.
And what if you get two builds, you don't know what to do with them, you were thinking you're fighting with Germany and you build two armies, here's the other thing. You don't really need them.
No, because you can't use them.
There's nowhere... I mean, there's just... What do we got? We got Marseille, then Burgundy, then Picardy, basically.
Right.
That's... three. So if you start with two armies and a fleet, you build an army and a fleet, there's three. And if you manage to get into Ruhr or Munich, you still really only need three. If you need another one, it's probably because you're working with England, and he can probably send one down there.
Right. One of those will be useless.
One of those will sit in Gascony or something.
And do nothing.
Or Paris. You don't need four. Your position is so much stronger. The only thing is, there is a diplomatic challenge to that if you've said to England and you've said to Italy, my target is Germany.
Sure.
You're going to have to build a fleet in either Brest or Marseille in 1902, and you're going to have to explain it to somebody at some point.
Yeah.
Because if you just do it and don't tell anybody about it, somebody's going to panic. You know,
tell somebody about it, though. You can justify both of them.
Yeah,
easily. You
definitely.
Can say, look, I have to build it somewhere. I don't get to pick where my ports are. If I could build it in Gascony or Spain south coast, I would. I can't.
Yeah.
So
a lot of times I'll tell in England, who I mean to be friendly to, look, I'm just going to like park one in mid-Atlantic and one in Spain, and they'll stay there until such time as I'm ready to attack somebody else or something like that. But the point is, they're a deterrent, and if all you need is armies to be attacking Germany, fine, you've got three. That's plenty.
Yeah. Don't ever make that mistake. You will regret it. I promise.
I have no earthly idea how you thought that was an answer to my last question, though.
What was your question?
My last question is, what do you do if you're getting attacked?
Oh, no. Well, the first thing I want to say, and this is before I answer that question. No, I'm kidding. So you're getting attacked. Am I being attacked in a way that is it in concert?
Well, you've got I mean,
I don't mean to make this into some sort of like 20 questions.
Totally hypothetical. let's say you've got an English guy in the channel and a German guy that doesn't seem particularly inclined to help.
I'm mostly the question is like, am I getting fully? Is it all three of them?
You don't have to deal with the circumstance where it's like you've got somebody in Piedmont, somebody in Burgundy, and somebody in the channel because you guessed wrong about everything or anything.
Right.
But just, I mean, let's just say it's become obvious in a year or two that two, if not all three of those guys want to take you down first.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, if there's someone in the channel, that's the eternal question. You just got to read the other guy. Mm-hmm. You've got to either cover it or not, and sometimes it's a coin flip.
Cover breast, you mean?
You've got to cover breast or not, and it's coin flip. Like, mm-hmm. sometimes they go, sometimes they don't. You just have to get a good read, and sometimes you guess right, sometimes you guess wrong.
Yep.
There's really not a lot you can do about that other than to offer them breast. Belgium.
Yeah.
Which is what I often do.
Mm-hmm.
And say, hey, you know what? Do you really need it? Why don't we work together? Try and flip it. I always try and pick up as many builds as possible so that I can batten down the hatches. I mean, and this is what the Englands rely on. They're like, oh, well, he's going to try and get Portugal and Brest, so I'm going to try for Portugal and Spain. I'm fixated on breasts.
You really are fixated on breasts.
Yeah.
They should border Naples.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Not my joke.
It's one of those,
not my joke.
One of those days, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I can see that. Anyway, no, so I don't know how to answer your question very well.
I guess my only thing I'd add to that is France's can just sort of go, okay, I'm a wall. You guys are coming after me. Try it. It's just going to be so slow by the time that I'm dead, it won't even matter anymore. And sometimes you can just, with a couple of good tactical guesses, you can just discourage concerted efforts against you. People can go, this is too hard. And I think that's more true than for France than a few other countries on the board. I think you can, when you're France, just play solid tactics at the beginning. If you're getting attacked, try not to lose too much too fast, and they might get bored. You might be able to sell them on a better plan. You might be able to turn one of them. So don't give up. I guess.
And there's a lot of like tactical, not having nothing to do with dots, but having to do with position.
Yeah,
that's very important.
Yeah,
like without getting into it, because that's just a whole another kettle of fish. You know, the importance of Gascony, the seeding of, you know, Burgundy over Picardy versus Marseille, you know, like all of those questions, like how you tactically guard against an invasion is important about lengthening the amount of time it takes for them to take you down.
Exactly. If you don't lose the Mid-Atlantic, it's pretty tough to lose. If you don't lose Burgundy, it's pretty tough to lose. If you do lose Burgundy, but you don't lose Gascony, there's a lot of stuff you can do. You know, hang on to two out of three of those spaces, if not all three, and you can just sit there all day.
Right.
It's no fun.
It's not fun, but it is sort of, it tends to get amusing. It's like one of those jokes that someone tells over and over until like you hit the seventh time and it becomes funny again.
Exactly.
Like eventually it becomes hysterical, in which you're just like, really, guys?
Yeah.
You're still here.
You've been attacking me for 4 years and you've gotten one. I'm still at four. And you've been attacking me for 4 years.
Which is definitely, by the way, boys and girls, what you really want to be underscoring for those folks in the spare time you have, not talking to Russia, Austria, Italy, and Turkey about how they should really be just climbing up into your opponent's backsides.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah.
It's good to, I mean, that's a whole other aspect of diplomacy. That's just a whole ton of fun.
Just beg the guys on the other side of them to be attacking them and just hang on and make good guesses.
Loudly.
It's very, very, very doable with France.
Yeah, absolutely.
What else? Oh, you know, openings, I guess.
You want to talk openings?
Sure.
We've gotten into mid-game without really talking about some specific openings, so I think let's just backtrack a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know how much needs to be said that we haven't already said, except there's some differences in what you do with the armies early on, and obviously the channel versus Mid-Atlantic is going to be...
It's a big dichotomy.
It's a diplomatic decision, though. It's not like a tactical, like, well, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. It's one of them you do if you want to be aggressive to England, one of them you do if you just want to get your neutrals. So there's not much to say about that, except... I mean...
You could be doing it because you are trying to artificially create such where you don't have to take both of the Iberian. I mean, you could open to the channel, sure, with the intent of taking Belgium and only dropping one down to take. Like, you could say, you know, support an opening into Burgundy and open to the channel and support from Burgundy into Belgium from the channel and then drop down in Spain.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You can be there as Belgium leverage, but it's still kind of anti-English. You know,
and that's kind of the advantage of it, right? I mean, the whole board thinks it's anti-English.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've talked to the English and you can somehow convince them to do it, which every once in a while you can.
That's true. That's true. It's not good for them, but maybe they don't know that. Or you're really persuasive.
Maybe it's not bad for them if they're really on board for this, like, anti-German idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
But most of the time, I think...
Yes, you're right.
Yeah. Being there is an anti-English play, and so you have to decide if you're... But I guess the one thing that we didn't say enough about is we've been assuming this entire time that you're moving two pieces in a position to take Portugal and Spain. If you're opening to the channel, you can still barely do that. If you're going to the channel, at that point, you have to go Marseille to Spain and Paris to Gascony in order to get both of, you know, so
you could do something embarrassing, like wedge that army up into Portugal and go, hey, guess where my army can't be for a year?
Yeah, anywhere good. So if you're going to do the channel thing, then probably if you're planning on building two at all, you better be hoping that your other one is Belgium at that point.
Oh, yeah,
whether you're using the channel to support it depends on what Germany does and what you've agreed upon with Germany. But, excuse me. But if you're going to the channel, have a plan to get Belgium.
Yeah. Oh, no, you have to. Which the problem is, if you do that, you're really committing because you have to have an army back there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And if you bounce in the channel, you're boned.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, I guess that's no more or less true whether you bounce in the channel or get the channel. You still probably move something else up near Belgium.
But you can do Picardy, and you would do that. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
But to be clear, the essence of what we're saying is there's a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. You either go channel or you go mid-Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Almost always people go mid-Atlantic. Probably you should do that too, unless you have a pretty good plan on either a build out of Belgium to compensate for what you're probably not getting in Iberia, or B, some sort of large, amazing plan with the Germans that you really believe in.
Exactly, exactly. If you did go to the Mid-Atlantic, the question with that fleet then is a question of follow-up. Whether that fleet takes Spain or Portugal, I think people sometimes underestimate how much that matters, because if you take Spain, if you're able to just open from Marseille to Spain, and then Brest to the Mid-Atlantic, then in the fall you go Spain to Portugal, then you can go Mid-Atlantic to Spain south mm-hmm. coast, and that's your most anti-Italian position. If the plan is I'm opening up a southern front sooner than later, like if we didn't even talk much about Western Triple, you know, in that case, that's definitely the tactically strongest move, because then you're already in Spain south coast.
Yeah, you could just whip right into Western Med or Gulf of Lyon.
Yeah, right. In a more conventional French opening, you for example, the one that we talked about where Marseille supports Paris to Burgundy, you obviously can't do that because then you're still in Marseille.
Right, they're doing a bounce in Burgundy.
And then you end up taking Portugal with the fleet, Spain with the army Marseille in the fall, and that's sort of the most conventional thing. But hey, then you're in Burgundy, and you have sort of more adventurous things that you can do.
And I guess we should, you know, what we didn't do, which is just silly. The absolutely most vanilla opening, for everybody, so that everybody knows, is opening to Mid-Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Paris probably goes to Picardy. Marseille probably goes to Spain.
Yeah,
that is the most vanilla. You see that more times mm-hmm. than probably anything else. There's nothing wrong with it. I just want to know what the baseline is. Let them know what the baseline is. That's what you would expect.
Yeah, definitely. Paris to Picardy is, I mean, it's kind of interesting move because it's a way of Burgundy and Picardy obviously both border Belgium, and so you're putting something on Belgium.
Yeah, which you're guaranteed to put something on Belgium.
It's a little more defensive against England. to do it that way. Because then you can cover breast if you have to, or do some different things. You're not going to Burgundy, so you're not irritating the German. So it's a totally, it doesn't really give anything away.
No, it doesn't.
I guess it's one thing about it.
Yeah, no, it's good. Like, and because there's every once in a while you see a bounce in Burgundy, which is like the biggest waste of time I can possibly, you know.
Yeah,
there are a few moves that are more wasteful in 0-1 than that kind of bounce.
Yeah, a security bounce in Burgundy is such a bummer because it actually, you and Germany then don't really have any influence on Belgium. It's just kind of a way of saying like, hey, to keep each other honest, all we've done is just completely given up on Belgium and we're just letting England take it.
We're just... In order to secure our borders, we're giving England Belgium. Wait a second.
Yeah, but you'll be surprised at how often you see it.
Yeah, no.
It's not a good move, though. I don't trust you, can we just do this thing? And if that's the case, like if the Germans coming to you and saying, I don't trust you, can we just do this security bounce thing? At that point, maybe you really think about just supporting yourself in.
Yeah.
Just being like, fine, well, if you don't trust me, at least I'm going to do something useful with this
piece. At least I can do something.
Support yourself in. Because, I mean, a German who wants that is insane. I mean, no German should want that. Germans should want to go to Ruhr because they shouldn't want to just do something that parks them back in Munich again. So if they want that, that's tactically pretty weak. But you know,
unless they know something, some crazy thing.
What else? I guess if you were doing that security bounce, you could do Marseille to Spain instead. Yeah. What are some other variations we're not thinking of here?
There's a bunch. I mean,
you can see how much we show prep for.
Well, no. I mean, but I think like there's really two dichotomies. Like there's the Burgundy dichotomy, and then there's the channel.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the two things that you're really looking at, and you're just trying to do it in such a way that you can protect against any potential Italian sort of shenanigans.
Yeah.
You're going to make sure that Burgundy isn't going to be a pain in your butt.
Mm-hmm.
And you balance that with what you think is going on with the channel. I mean, that's really... everything is, I think, more than a lot of other countries. France is really taking its vanilla opening and sort of like just changing it based on what is going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, because... fundamentally, when you have this like great like treasure trove in your back door, you're just trying to figure out the most optimal way to get to it.
Yeah, definitely. And the one thing about that is it is in your back door, and as you so eloquently put it, it is in your back door, and it's not like the pieces that go there to claim it are gonna kind of be out of the action for a little while because they had to go kind of the wrong way to do it, and obviously you're replacing them with your new builds, and they'll get to the front eventually. But putting a little bit of thought into exactly what pieces I want out of the action and for how long is something worth considering. For example, the thing I mentioned about, like, if you take Portugal with your fleet, that thing, it goes Brest to the Mid-Atlantic, Mid-Atlantic, Portugal, Portugal to the Mid-Atlantic, Mid-Atlantic to somewhere else, or else Portugal to Spain, Spain to somewhere else. But either way, that fleet... Great, you got Portugal, but it's going to not really be doing anything all that exciting for a year or so, you know, until basically fall 1902 is the first time that piece is going to do anything. So just make sure you have a plan in terms of, you know, what you're going to build, where those first pieces are going to go, because it's going to take a little while for the reinforcements. And I think some Frances get into a spot where... Like, they just have a couple pieces that are just sort of meandering around some combination of, like, the Mid-Atlantic and Gascony and Marseille, and they're never really sure what to do with them. And it's almost a luxury that they have those, but you should sort of be planning from 01, how am I going to get these things back into the action?
It should at least, and it's going to probably change, but at least... When you start out the gate and you have your target, sort of play towards that target.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like if it's England, move your pieces such that they're going to get to the English front as quickly as possible. If it's Italian, you know, vice versa. You know.
Yep.
That's. I'm just repeating what you're saying in a more clear way.
Yeah.
So how, Eric? How do I win with France? Like, I want to win.
I feel like I've done that. Have you?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't.
I'm sure I have.
Yeah. Well,
because France wins a lot. That's the other thing about it. Like, it wins a lot.
Yeah.
I think more than any other country, I think.
That's true, it's not true by much, because Russia's, like, right there with it.
Yeah, but it's France and Russia, though.
Definitely are the top two in terms of soloing overall. Excuse me. And they're down. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. And they're down a little bit on eliminations too. Like France doesn't get eliminated much in comparison to some other countries. So they win a lot and they draw a lot, which is
why everyone's excited about getting them.
Yep, definitely. The wins. I mean, I think most of them happen in the Med.
You think?
The Mediterranean? Yeah, I'd say you've conquered some good, decent chunk of the West. Maybe not the stuff that's farthest from you in the West, like Scandinavia, although you might have.
Yeah, it's possible.
You know, it's not that hard once you're done with once you're done killing England to move on and kill, and pound on Scandinavia next, because it was probably mostly him that was there to begin with. As you're encircling Germany, obviously, if you're planning on conquering most of the West. So your 18th center is going to be, you know, one or two or three over the line, probably Italian/Tunis centers. Variations on that depend on how long I think you've stuck with your ally. You know, it's possible that you have relatively little of the West, and, you know, you've just done this really long-term England-France thing where England's all the way to Moscow and you're all the way to, you know, Greece, for example, and you've stuck with your ally, and then maybe you stab him at the end and take some stuff out west.
Sure. But what do you think is the better vehicle? Is it the EF or the EG?
Or the FG, you mean?
That's what I said.
Yeah. Oh, no, you didn't.
Of course that's what I said. I know what I'm talking about.
It's on tape, man.
Damn it. No, which is... I mean, am I hitching my wagon to England or Germany?
They're kind of similar in terms of where you end up, right?
At the back door, easily stabbing either one of them?
Well, that and in terms of where you've stretched it to if you've stuck with them for a long time.
Sure.
Like, one of them is going to be in Scandinavia and Russia. You know, whichever it is that's your ally. Although with some slight variation on each, obviously.
You're going to be
stretched through and trying to pound on Italy and you know, maybe even Austria after that. And even Turkey, you know, like you're just
depending how
med,
that
med, med, med.
Yeah.
It depends how your target got carved, your initial Western target got carved up, who's going to own what. Like, for example, like the FG, you alluded briefly, like, you're probably going to have most of England, and Germany's probably going to have most of, like, the mainland stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously there's some careful dot counting that you do at that point to do when you're in either one of those alliances and it's successful and you're both at 11, you're both at 12, you kind of have to be careful about...
Is there one that's easier? I mean, that's, I think, really the question.
For winning?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I guess it's probably harder to stab England for the win.
Yeah.
Unless he's overextended, unless you have, like, that one good turn down south while he has a bad turn up north.
I would tend to agree with that. I would think if you're trying to win, you want to go with the FG.
Yeah, for because just dropping a stab into there. But then again, it's probably a little easier for him to stab you, too.
A little bit. Depends on, like you said, how the dots are divided up.
Yeah, if somebody has a good turn and somebody has a bad turn, just building, you know, if one of you builds two while the other one doesn't build or has to disband or something like that, that's a time that all of a sudden French armies come marching into the German mainland or German armies come marching into the French mainland. It's not quite as smooth for a France to stab in England because it takes a little while to sail there.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can pull enough back to protect themselves. So, I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. Like, I guess... The England is a little more long-term stable, and the FG you have to be a little more careful with to make sure that you can't get stabbed as quickly. But the FG, if you are careful with it, I think it's also kind of more powerful because both of you are building closer to where you're attacking.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, if you're trying for movement...
If you guys did a really good job of it, and you've managed to just not have anything in the mainland, you know, you've walked every single... threatening thing out of the West and to where it should be, and you're being careful about who's building what when, it's a more elegant alliance, I think. But it just takes more work to do that.
Well,
so
yeah.
that's my take on that. And then for soloing, well, then I guess maybe I'd say the same thing about that. I'd say that for soloing, you might be better off with the guy that's easier to stab after he gets overextended. So
all of you listening at home, Eric likes the FG.
Because he likes to try and solo.
It actually sounds like you'd like to do it no matter what, even if you're going to try and solo or not.
For all of you listening who are actually taking notes on our play from this, that's kind of scary. We're going to have to listen to the episodes before we go to tournaments and try and do the opposite just to freak people out.
I've listened to everything you guys talked about, and I'm gonna get you guys.
which is where you actually play with us, and you figure out that actually no, it doesn't.
First person who plays one of these with us, plays a game of diplomacy with us, and comes up to me and says, "Hey, Eric, let's do a Western triple." Murder.
It's gonna be great.
Yeah.
No, you're gonna hate it. You're gonna write your Cookie Monster orders, and you're gonna be so angry.
Oh, I'll look all sad. Yeah. And my face will turn red.
Yeah, it'll be perfect. Anyway, no, so I don't actually have a lot. I actually agree with most of your analysis, because France is interesting in that I don't have a strong opinion on which one you have to go with to really that is the sure path to victory. I think they're both, you know, all paths to 18 dots are precarious. But, you know, in that, I really think what you're trying to do as much as possible is try and take over the entire West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The surest path to victory is to kill them both.
Yeah,
in one order or another.
So,
although
I personally think you're better off not getting too far down the long term alliance with them. But that's really hard to do.
I can see that. They can lock you up in the East.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, don't do it too soon. Unless it's great. Unless it's going to be like you can't necessarily become such an unstoppable juggernaut just by killing, for example, Germany, then England, that the East can't organize and put a stop to it. You'll be big,
in a five-way draw.
Yeah, exactly. And you got to be careful of that. You know, like, it is tough, even for the great French guy, to try and pound, like, let's say you've already taken all of Germany, and now you're trying to force past there to places like Tyrolia and Bohemia and Silesia to try and get something like that land war, is not easy for France. No. I mean, it's rare that you're going to have enough force up there that they can't stop you across the center. So hopefully you were either already across the center by the time you made that move, or the East is just in such chaos and sanctimony that I don't even care anymore. Or, you know, obviously, anytime you're soloing, it's because somebody's not doing their job. But I guess if you are going to force it, be over the line in the Med first.
Oh, yeah.
If you can possibly help it. Yeah. And if you want to do, like, the long-term France-Italy thing, I don't know, even worth touching on.
I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
Because it never comes up.
Yeah.
I mean, both powers tend to be a little bit on the fleet-heavy side.
Mm-hmm. I guess you could win with, say, the whole West plus Warsaw.
Yeah.
You know, but then I'm penciling you in for Norway, St. Pete, and Sweden, which is no easy task.
Is that enough?
Yeah.
Don't you have Moscow? You could do Moscow or Warsaw.
Moscow or Warsaw or Vienna or, you know.
Oh, you're pushing it with Vienna.
Yeah, exactly. It's not as easy by land, I guess, is the short form of that. All right, we've gone on enough about soloing as France. It's pretty speculative. We'll ask David Hood more about it. Oh, yeah. So we have an interview coming up.
Yeah, we do have an interview. We should ask David Hood about it.
Yeah, I'll bet David Hood has soloed a time or two as France.
I bet David Hood has soloed a time or two as every country this weekend.
Yeah, probably. I'll bet David Hood has made a little girl cry soloing on her before. as France and almost every other country.
I actually think that's true.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but...
No, but David Hood's coming up. Guys, hold on. This guy, literally, I don't know... He's awesome.
We're going to try not to talk to him for like 2 hours. That's our current goal.
He's such a wonderful guy, and he does so much for the hobby, and really, really, really somebody that should be listened to. He's a So many war stories I could tell.
Okay, they get it, Nathan. They get it. Easy there.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to tear up. I didn't mean to tear up there. Right, I got.
So stay tuned for that. Thanks. Joining us now, the inimitable David Hood from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Is that where you are, David?
Actually, I'm in Hickory, North Carolina, a much more important place. Much more important place.
Especially important in that it is made up to sound southern and charming, but does not actually exist.
No, I'm pretty sure it exists.
I'm going to let Nathan tell our listeners a little more about David Hood at this point and all of the reasons.
Wait, is that just because you don't know? You don't have no idea who he is. Have you ever met him?
Yes, of course I've met him many, many times.
Oh, good. Oh, okay.
But no, it's just that you were such a fan in the
I was
last
a little. I'm a little bit of a fanboy. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Well, primarily aside from being a very charming gentleman, Mr. Hood, I think, is best known for running one of the longest and most successful tournaments out there, Dixiecon.
Yep.
What year are you on? Is it the 25th anniversary, something like
that? Yes, we just finished our 25th tournament.
We just had your champion on last week, Doug Moore, and I'll ask you the same question I asked him. Why do you keep letting him come to that thing? He always wins.
Well, it's funny because there were a couple of years that he was late, and I held on for him. And he won both times. So I was surprised that nobody killed me up there. And none of the other players. Why did you let Doug actually play? But he's just astoundingly good. That's the thing.
I know. It's
really good.
It's annoying.
It is really annoying.
It can be, yes.
So 25 years. So can you just tell our listeners a little bit about what Dixiecon is, and then I just kind of want to get your thoughts, like a little bit of reflections on what the event has evolved into over the years.
Well, Dixiecon started, of course, in 1987, which is why we just finished our 25th anniversary. And it started as the tournament for our diplomacy group. At that time, we had a very large North Carolina diplomacy group.
Oh.
And so that's how it started. And actually, the current or the then editor of Diplomacy World suggested that we start the tournament.
Now,
because we had such a big group of players,
were you already kind of plugged into tournament diplomacy at that time? Like, did you already travel to go to tournaments back then?
I had been to one other tournament.
Okay,
when I started Dixon. The first time we ever ventured out as a group was in 1986 when we, four or five or six of us, went to the DIPCON that year, which was in Virginia.
Okay.
And that's the first time we ever knew about tournaments. And then actually, while we were there, the Diplomacy World guy said, you know what you guys ought to do is just start a tournament down there because there's never been a tournament in North Carolina, and who knows how it'll go. And we were very organized in those days, so it was really not difficult to consider. We had actually scored every game we ever played as a group, beginning with the first game any of us ever played. And
wow.
We had a scoring system, our own scoring system. We had 100 and something games by then. So we were overly organized before we had a tournament.
Right.
So it really wasn't that much of a change.
And it was.
And I had been a debater in college and had been to many debate tournaments, so I was used to the idea of a tournament and how you set it up,
right,
and how you promote it and that kind of stuff.
So after, in its current form, it's sort of evolved over the years and it's maintained. One of the. Why do people like it so much? I guess is really what I'm. I won't be clever with my question.
That was not a very clever question.
No,
Nathan, but I will answer it anyway.
No, it wasn't. Why do people like it?
You mean other than the barbecue on Saturday?
Well,
which is it's a very popular thing.
It was definitely that kind of locked it in for me. When I was like, I'm coming next year. There's barbecue.
Yeah, we won't get into that too much, except that that is a popular part of the popular part of the tournament. I think the main reason that people enjoy it now is because it's kind of something they always do over Memorial Day. You know, it's not that we don't have new players, but we have a lot of the same players coming every year. And now we, of course, we have people that have literally been coming every year for 20 years. So it really now is a place you go hang out with your friends for the weekend.
Yeah.
And I know this is a diplomacy podcast, but one of the reasons that we have so many people come back is just not just to play diplomacy, it's to play other games with their friends. We last year we had more people that played other games. We have a kind of a side tournament for all of our non-diplomacy games called the Iron Man of Gaming. And that tournament actually had more players in it last year than the diplomacy tournament did. But this year the diplomacy tournament had more players in it. But so I think people come, and this is something that tournament organizers, of course, always need to keep in mind, is that the diplomacy is great. It's the main raison d'etre for the tournament. But that's not really what brings people back year after year. What really brings people back is something unique about your tournament, whether it's location, the people are different than the people they play with all the time, or, you know, frankly, the little side things that are fun, like the barbecue. I mean, I was making a joke about that, but that's, if you've got something that's tradition, it's not just playing the game, That little gimmick can actually bring people back, and then once they go so many times, it becomes a part of their normal schedule.
I have one other thing to add to that. Do you guys still give out the brick every year?
Yes, we do.
Could you please tell our listeners about the brick?
The brick.
Well, the brick is a coveted award. And what it is a brick that is procured by some secret agent of the tournament. From somewhere off of one of the many construction sites on the UNC campus. There's always at least one. So somebody goes and gets a brick. And what we do is we basically give it to whoever we think deserves to get a brick every year. It does not have a specific meaning, but it's usually a negative meaning. It usually means that you've done something or acted in some fashion or said something that justifies giving you a piece of masonry as your award.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it, was that you just sort of debate about who deserves the brick and why every year.
Who gets to carry this
back
home?
Really has a different, it has a different meaning to everyone. This year, of course, this year it was given to Jim Yerke.
Oh, really?
Because he actually, because he qualified. Well, this year we had a special tournament called the All-Time Greats, because it was our 25th anniversary.
Oh, yes.
If you had finished in the top three, which we at DixieCon call the Hall of Fame, if you had finished in the top three any of the past 25 DixieCons, you were eligible to play in this tournament. It's kind of a side tournament to see who the overall champion was of all time for DixieCon. Yerke actually qualified, as you might suspect, to play in the final board of that, and then said he didn't want to. And so for that, he got the brick.
He got the brick. That seems fair.
Yerke.
And he also got the Golden Blade Award for doing that, because by doing so, Siegel got to play in the final board, and so all the other players complained about that.
Oh, man.
And but my theory was that Jim Yerke had stabbed the rest of the board.
Actually, that is fair. I would be upset too.
Obviously, our listeners probably don't know who any of these people are, but yeah.
Well, that's fine.
It makes sense.
But you know, if I can make a broader point about that, it's not that any of the names I just mentioned are all that important. It's that we all are such good friends.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And exactly.
That, you know, that's actually why people come to DixieCon. It's why people go to any tournament after a couple of years, is because they're looking to see people they know and meet new people. And
sure.
And that's part of what it's about.
You get out and compete in tournaments like as often as you're able to, which is not very often, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Are you good?
In some years, I'm just not that enthusiastic about it. I know it's hard for anybody to believe, but there is such a thing as burnout.
Yeah.
And sometimes, going and playing in a diplomacy tournament is not. That's actually never why I go to a diplomacy tournament anymore. It's because I've got some burning desire to win the tournament. It's because I want to see people I know or meet new people.
Yeah.
It's really all about the people.
I think if this hobby, goes another 100 years, you'll probably be the only person with a 25th anniversary of a tournament. So we say you're allowed a little burnout.
Yeah.
Well, I've never burned out of running the tournament.
Right.
Just to be honest, I've done it so often that it's almost on autopilot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can do it without a lot of independent thought. But I do like to go to diplomacy tournaments when I can. My schedule's kind of tough, but when I can, I love to go.
Yeah. Just play to play.
And I've been to Seattle a couple of times.
Yes, you have.
And I just thought those were both great experiences for me, even though I didn't really go to compete in the tournament. In fact, as you may know, I always want to sit out.
Yes, you do have a bad habit.
The numbers are not...
If
the numbers are not working out, I'm always the first volunteer to sit out. Cause, you know, I've played this game a million times. I want to let someone else play. You know?
Exactly. We obviously, as we told you earlier, we've spent a good chunk of time talking about France. Is it? And I think the reason we wanted to talk to you about it, I think it was simply because we didn't have a person. It's such a country that. Well, I don't know. It's a country that is. It's a winning country. I wanted to get a perspective of someone who's played a lot of games. So I think what we're really looking for, David, is I think some guidance. Like how do you really approach this country?
Because you're kind of a France specialist, right?
Well, sort of. I did write the Playing France section of the Gamer's Guide in 1992, and Avalon Hill republished the Gamer's Guide to Diplomacy.
Published France author, David.
When you say republished, was there a Gamer's Guide beforehand?
Yeah, I had it when I was a kid. I totally had it. It was awesome.
Yes, I had it. We bought it when we bought our first game back in 1984. They had the Gamer's Guide for sale right next to it.
Wow.
And,
It was actually pretty cool.
And you got to remember, this is years and years before the internet, so it's not like you had a lot of readily available information about how to play this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember finding it in a game store and just thinking it was solid gold. Like I read,
was it Richard Sharp that did it originally?
No, I'm trying to
not that one. That's a different.
That's the book. Okay,
I forget which one I had.
I somehow.
So this was the Gamer's Guide. It was largely written by a guy named Rod Walker. Was a big-time hobbyist in California back in the 60s and 70s and some of the 80s.
Okay.
And it had some bias in it for his because it was not, you know, it was not a bunch of different authors. It was just him. But not to get too far off track from France, I'll tell you why I think France is such a great country to play and how much I enjoy playing it.
Okay.
It's because you have so many options as France. People think that you have a particular thing you should do as France in like a 1901, but the truth is that you actually have a lot of cool options that you can try out, and many of them actually make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think we spent just a bunch of our time in our segment of it talking about just, you know, there's you ally with Germany and go after England, you ally with England, you go after Germany, but I mean, I guess within that, there's a lot of ways to do it, depending on, like, the board situation. Is that kind of what you mean?
That is exactly what I mean, and there are also some interesting openings you can do as France, and you know, Austria also has a lot of cool, bizarre, unusual openings that I like to use.
Mm-hmm.
But France has them as well, and much more so than somebody like England does. England just basically has two openings, really, that make any sense. And France has them like four or five. So let's talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Usually French players will send two units southwest to take the two Iberian centers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third unit will have something to say about Belgium, you know, supporting someone in, bouncing someone in Belgium, hopefully taking Belgium. That's kind of a traditionalist way of playing France. I think it's a mistake because your units are going the wrong way. It's like if you're a fan of Game of Thrones, you know, there's a great line from that show and that book about how the troops are marching the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
And it's
they should be marching north.
They should be marching north, right? And it's really true for the French. They really should be marching north or east, not marching southwest. There's nobody down there. to fight. So if you go down there and take those neutrals, that seems good at the time, but your units are out of position to do anything interesting in O2.
Yeah, we did touch on that. It really takes a, it takes them almost
right.
2 years, basically, so to get back in the action.
But what do you,
one of the options the French have is to just maybe just send one guy down there. Either just send the fleet to the mid-Atlantic and just take Portugal and then take Spain in O2 with that fleet.
Well,
or maybe just send the Army Marseille down there and use the US to screw around in the West.
What do you?
Because the real key here is Belgium. That's the key. It's Belgium.
So many times I've seen players play this, and I what would you say to a player let's say you're GMing or something, or what do you say to someone to kind of resist the temptation just to send those things? It's so easy to do, to pick up Spain and Portugal. You're not hurting anybody. And I think there's such a temptation to do that. I mean,
let me say it this way, Nathan. If you're not hurting somebody, you're not really playing the game.
Oh.
The whole game is to kill people. That's the whole game.
That is kind of true.
Their stuff. So, is to be like Conan from the first Conan movie. You know, you kill your enemies, you drive them before you, and you hear the lamentations
of their women. That's why I got into diplomacy, too.
That's pretty much what the game is about. So if you are tempted to be one of these guys that just grabs his neutrals in O1 and looks to see what happens, mostly you're looking to see what other people do.
Boy, that's...
Because the other people are going to control the pace of the game and not you.
I feel like I don't play France that way enough. I feel like I play some countries that way where I'm just like, oh, I just got to go a direction right away. But a lot of the advice that we gave earlier in the show is sort of the opposite of that. It was just more about like not getting jumped in 0-1 and just kind of locking it up and get it in.
From our experience, which is getting beat up as France.
Right.
Well, you know, to be honest, there's nothing wrong with that way of thinking if your goal in the game is not to get killed. If your goal is to, you know, not be jumped and to sort of survive into the late part of the opening part of the game, then fine. Be defensive, take your centers, and see what happens. To me, that's not a very good recipe for getting 18 centers.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is the whole point. I play the game.
Yeah.
If I don't win the game, I'm not really all that happy about the result.
So then are you, to go back sort of to the opening part of it for a minute, are you comfortable, say, only building one in 1901 if it means that you get that sort of extra forward position?
Absolutely. In fact, there's another advantage to that, which is keeping yourself under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
If you build two or if you build three, which, you know, sounds like a cool idea at the time.
God forbid for France, usually.
You may actually, you know, warning bells may be going off in the East if you do that.
That's so true.
Whereas if you just build one, oh, we just built one. That's not, I mean, that's sort of like a bad Austrian opening where you only get Serbia or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not very scary. Or even if you build two, if you take Belgium and then one of the Iberian things, that's not so awful.
Yeah, that's kind of the ideal. I agree with that. Well, I think if you can kind of convince the board, look, France always builds two, I'm building two, but one of them's Belgium, and then you have the other Iberian kind of in your pocket.
Yeah, we were talking about that, but what I like about what David's suggesting is, you know, the culture is such that, you know, you would just expect France to have two. If you're only building one, somehow... Even if that one is Belgium, somehow you're less scary or quote unquote weak, which is, you know, could be advantageous.
It's true.
Yeah, you certainly don't appear to be all that strong if you've got four units. But unless the Italians are in a good position to come after Iberia, you're in a powerfully strong position. If all three of your units, because this is an opening I like to try sometimes, is just not go to Iberia at all in 0-1 and send your fleet to the channel and the armies to Picardy and Burgundy. You're locking down, and it is a little aggressive, I grant you that.
But you're locking
Belgium down, which is sort of the whole point of the early West, figuring out who's going to own Belgium.
Sure.
And you're basically saying, it's going to be me. I'm going to own Belgium. I've got three guys on it, so what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And then you can use the bills for Belgium to go back and take one of the Iberian centers in there, too. I mean, it depends on the situation.
Yeah.
That's generally what you do.
But I guess it just makes, it just makes positioning that much more important. If you're going to play that sort of slow, I'm building one a turn, you're going to do that in exchange for getting into more and more interesting spaces, like, you know, getting sooner.
As they say in the real estate business, location, location, location.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's also true in, when you're trying to get the jump on your adversaries, which to me is how you, let's put it this way, it's how I play the game. I try to get the jump on people.
Yeah.
I don't want to be in some long tactical battle because, for one thing, I'm probably going to lose that. I make tactical mistakes. I need to jump on people.
Not us. Never.
it's true. So, the other thing about opening that way, and I'm not saying you always open that way. I don't open that way all the time by any means. But it does give you options as to which of those two guys you're going to go after.
Yeah, and it lets you sort of go faster at whichever one of them it is, I suppose.
Indeed.
Well, with that opening you're describing, Picardy, Channel, Burgundy, which one does that really sort of position you to attack?
I think it positions you to attack either one.
Yeah.
Now, okay.
Great. The trick is that you might just be making both of them mad at you.
That's
so
true.
You have to this all has to do, and surprisingly, with diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
In the diplomacy game, you've got to be able to explain to England why you did it, so he doesn't get mad. You've got to be able to explain to Germany, which is a little easier to explain to him.
Yeah.
Because going to Burgundy is almost expected for France, or at least is certainly not unusual. Going to the Channel as France in 01 is very unusual. I mean, England goes to the Channel a lot more than France does.
Right.
It just occurred to me also that if Germany bounces you there in Burgundy, having told you that he's going to do so or not having told you that he's going to do so, then, hey, you can just take Spain as a backup plan.
That is exactly right.
That's kind of awesome, actually.
I know exactly how your opening is France next time you play. Yeah. Great. Perfect.
Here's another fun French opening. You tell the German that you want to bounce in Burgundy. Then you support yourself there. So you go Paris to Burgundy in support of Marseille. Now you've stranded the German in Munich where it can do nothing in the fall term. But your guy in Spain, your guy in Marseille certainly can. He can go to Spain.
Still go to Spain. Exactly. And your guy in Burgundy could go to Belgium if you were so inclined.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it depends on what your fleet did. If your fleet went to the Channel, you've got two on Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Or if your fleet went to Mid-Atlantic, obviously you can take both neutrals. If you want, but you have gotten a position jump on Germany. You've slowed them down by a turn by stranding them in Munich, which is a forlorn city.
Yeah.
It doesn't touch anything they can take.
A little extra aggression from France. I'm liking it. I'm definitely liking it. Maybe we've been too cautious for a while now.
It's not my nature to be cautious anyway, to be honest. And you have to play to your nature. I'm not suggesting that people who are not naturally aggressive or risk-taking when they play should just go do it all the time. It might not work for you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth a try, though, if you're open to the idea of being more aggressive. I think that's true for almost every country in diplomacy. There are ways to be aggressive
from
the very beginning that can really help you.
Working forward a little bit from there to, like, a mid-game, To have done well getting to the mid-game, you've probably made an alliance, at least one, with one of England or Germany, and you're growing some. Well, first of all, I guess, do you have a preference?
Sounds like...
Yeah.
Sounds like you're kicking Germany's ass.
I actually like to ally with Germany if I have a choice between the two.
Okay.
Putting all other issues aside, personalities are the most important issue.
Right, obviously.
But if you can make a good alliance with the German against the English, it's better for the French because England is a longer term threat than Germany is in the mid or later stages of the game. So getting the English out of there and getting yourself in the corner, where with some easily defensible centers in the corner, can be very good for France. So that would be my preference. Having been said, I've played EF Alliance games and enjoyed them immensely. I remember one in particular that I did in the DivCon in 2001 John Saul and I play. I think I was France, New Zealand, and we just swept the board.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's fun to do.
Kind of like actual history.
If I had my druthers, I'd rather do Germany, I think.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's probably easier to get the drop on Germany is at a key moment in the game. Like, if you want to kind of go for the win, you're a little closer in that case. That's one thing.
Well, yeah, and it's you've got to be able to... You have to manufacture a situation to get that drop on England as France.
Yeah.
A lot. I mean, it's a lot easier for that to come up if you're attacking Germany later in the game rather than, you know, some sprawling English monster with fleets all over the place.
He can be hard to take down. You kind of have to have that one turn, I suppose, where you built two and he disbanded one or something, where you can just really just jump down England's throat and he can't do anything about it if he gets overextended or whatever. Whereas,
So,
but the inverse is true also. Germany can get a better drop on you if he has a good, in terms of an FG alliance, you can get a better drop on him, but he can get a better drop on you too. So it's,
I think that's true. It is actually somewhat risky.
Yeah.
From a defensive point of view, you might actually be better off if you're trying to avoid getting stabbed if England is your ally, if you play it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never my goal. I'm not trying to avoid getting stabbed. I'm trying to be the one to win.
Exactly.
So are you the type of player that if, you know, you're going to be aggressive and you would rather go down in a ball of flames than, say, take a four-way draw?
I would, because I'd rather go down in a ball of flames and go play something else than sit around for a long time. Now, some people actually enjoy long games with long stalemate line battles and stuff. I used to enjoy those 20 years ago. Now I actually just want to play and win, and if I'm not going to win, I'd rather go play something else.
There's barbecue at stake.
Sounds like a baby. You know, I want to win.
Mm.
But, you know, the bottom line is the reason people don't win deployments is because they don't try to.
Yeah.
You have to actually try to win. You have to have it in your head that you can get 18, and here's how I'm going to do it. And a lot of players, I would say most players, go into a game diplomacy with no such plan and no such expectation, which guarantees that they're never going to win a game.
And I feel like that's so true. I feel like so many people just go, 18 isn't there. I'm just not even going to try. And I always just say, where's the downside? Yeah, why are you not going for it here? I mean, the worst thing that you're not going to get eliminated, you know, if you're at a position where you're trying to decide whether to go for a solo or not, it's probably because you're doing fairly well, and it's not like the board is going to be so mad that they're going to, well, occasionally, but usually.
It depends on the board.
Yeah, usually.
Well,
there is a downside
to going for the win that keeps people from doing it that otherwise might try it. And it's the idea that if they try and fail, they're actually setting someone else up to win because they've basically disrupted the alliance structure of the game and kept, you know, they've somehow disrupted the ability of one side of the board to keep the other side from winning.
Right.
That's why, particularly in tournament play, that wins are sometimes not attempted because they're afraid it's just going to make the other guy, you know, one of the other guys on the other side of the board win.
Right.
So I'm not saying that you always just willy-nilly go for the win and you don't really care about what happens if you don't win. That's not suggesting. But you certainly need to try to have a plan for winning. And a lot of people just don't have that plan, which is why, for me, the plan to win is to be aggressive from the beginning. Just going after the neutrals and sitting around to see what happens.
Are you there?
See what happens.
Oh, we lost just a second there. I don't know.
Could you just repeat your last sentence? What did you say? You said plan for aggression.
Yeah. If your plan is to take neutrals and sit around and look for opportunities instead of having an actual plan of aggression against one of your neighbors, then it's more likely you're just going to sit around and wait for them to have a plan of aggression against you.
Yeah, exactly.
You just need to be the one that takes the initiative in the game, or at least that's the way I've always thought.
That's good general advice right there. I think all of the best players of the game sort of think along those lines, no question about it. Taking that back to France for just a moment, the getting to 18 question with France, is there a... Is there a pathway you think is most common? Is there a pathway you think is best with that particular country?
Or another way of saying it, what's your, like, down and dirty core advice to someone who wants to win as France?
Well, you know, we've already talked about what my first point of advice would be, which is to not be passive and not assume that what you should do is just go to Iberia and then see what happens. You should actually not do that. You should, in my opinion, unless the situation is drastically different than usual, you should just send one unit to Iberia in the beginning.
Okay.
And use your other two to get a jump on whoever your target is. So to me, that's pretty important to winning, is the speed in which you take control of your side of the board. But now, you can't be distracted, which would be my second point, by, you don't want to send people into the med too early when you're French. You want to make sure you've got the West figured out first before you do that. But then my third point would be, you've got to go to the med, and you've got to do it when the timing is right, because that's the way you get 18. There's stuff down there you need.
Mm-hmm.
You need Tunis or Rome or, you know, in the right kind of game, you need Venice. I mean, it just depends on what the situation is. But you're going to need one or two of those centers most likely to win the game. And the way that you do that is to go down there, sometimes to attack the Italians and take their stuff. Sometimes you're going down there to save the Italians.
Sure.
Because the Turks are coming after them. And you're going down there and you basically go to the Italians and say, I'm sending two fleets and you can write their orders.
Yeah.
Right, whatever you want, they will do.
They'll be mercenaries for you. Just tell me what you want them to do.
Yeah.
Now, of course, at some point, you decide those orders are not good, and you stab him instead.
But it's amazing how often he's
down there.
It's amazing how often he's still more mad at the Turk after you've done that. He's just like, oh, as long as it's just France that's taking my dots, that's fine. Yeah.
Well, and of course, all of this has to do with your diplomatic skills.
Yeah.
You've got to. I've said this many times, the way you win a game, Chris Martin and I have had this discussion many times, the way you win a game is because other people don't mind if you win.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Really, if you're playing in a game of diplomacy with any kind of decent players, I'm putting aside novice players for a minute, because sometimes they don't know how to stop you from winning, but if you've got players of any decency on the board, you're not going to win the game, most likely, unless you have analyzed and manipulated the emotional reactions of the players on the board and make sure that they're mad at each other and that they don't really care if you win, as long as that blankety-blank card gets what's coming to you.
Exactly.
That's how you win a game of diplomacy for the most part in most tournaments, is to be able to do that.
No question.
The French coming to the rescue of the Italians is an excellent example of how you build up that goodwill. And, you know, even if you stab them later for the win, you know, you say, you've got such a good relationship with them, you built up a lot of trust, they might not care because you saved them from the dastardly Turk.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, it's just one of those things.
Well, yeah, and sometimes it's much better to go, oh, yeah, Mr. Turk, you've just totally... ruined my game. You were all over me. The French here, I like them. I'm going to give them my centers and see how you like that. I don't mind
doing that when I'm losing anyway. I don't mind giving them to, you know, David Hood, for example. It's probably never David Hood that I'm mad at.
But, no, probably not.
I hope not, or I haven't done my
No, all right.
We've taken more than enough of your time on France, but yeah, but we're going to take a couple minutes because you know that's the kind of guys we are.
I like that.
Do you have a quick, the biggest mistake you've ever made on a diplomacy board story for our listeners? Because
we love
everyone loves those stories.
Well, I once convoyed another unit, an enemy unit, or another player's unit into my last center, thus eliminating myself.
You did what?
Which is kind of hard to do when you think about it. I mean, what would possess you to do that?
Did you
when you say it, did you accidentally did that?
Did you forget what your one dot was?
I accidentally did it in the sense that I didn't realize that was going to be my last center on the board. But I was England. I think the situation was I was England. The French had just decided to come after me. They were sending their fleets to England. All of my units, my armies, were on the continent doing something.
Uh-huh.
And the only way that I could really defend myself was to put an army in England to help defend against the French. The only army available was a Russian one.
Okay.
So basically, I worked out a deal where I can't remember if it was his idea or my idea, but it was a bad idea, and it was sending the Russian into England, and I was to take one of the Russian centers on the continent in as a recompense.
Mm-hmm.
But at least his army would help defend in England, because I needed an army to defend. There were French coming on the Liverpool side, so we needed an army and a fleet to help defend. Unfortunately, I was stabbed at the same time by everyone on the continent and lost all my centers there. So the only move that I did that actually worked was convoying a Russian into Edinburgh, thus ending my game.
That is truly magnificent.
It was a clever way to be idiotic.
Yeah,
is what it was.
I think you should have claimed you did that on purpose.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's probably a better story if it had been on purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
It was actually intended to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Which is shocking when you think of it.
All right, Mr. Hood. Final thoughts? Anything? What do you got coming up? Anything before DixieCon next year, or do you just go into a deep hibernation at this point?
You know, I do actually go into a hibernation, generally speaking. I will say that if you haven't played at DixieCon before, I hope that you will consider doing it, and both of you guys have, but I'm talking to your listeners here.
Yeah.
Not just because I run the tournament. I just think it's fun to go to different places and meet different people. Plus, how many times can you go to a diplomacy tournament and listen to people that talk with my accent?
It
just doesn't happen that much.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but yeah.
I don't really have an accent. You guys have an accent. But I know that not everyone agrees with that, and they think that I'm the one with the accent. So if you want to hear people like me talk, there's really only one place to go do that.
We have that horrible...
Not to mention the fact that we have good barbecue.
I would also add that it's extremely near to several local bars, and when you are finished drinking at those one of several local bars, there are, like, southern kind of egg sandwich biscuit things that at two in the morning when you've been drinking are about the best thing in the world, and yeah.
Wow, it sounds like you had quite an experience.
North Carolina's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like. I suddenly really like the idea that I have a terrible northern twang.
Yeah, seriously. it's hard to even listen to.
I love the thought of that. Well, David, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us and to really school us on how to actually play France.
Yeah, I feel like maybe I've learned more from this interview.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's going to change more about how I play next time than any of the other interviews we've done. No offense, everyone.
Well, you guys don't have a lot to learn. You're both great players. I play with both of you, so you could just drop all pretense here about having learned squat. You're both great players.
See, thanks, now. See, this is where all that goodwill comes from.
He's breaking the fourth wall.
Exactly.
Stop him.
All right. Again, thanks, David. We'll talk to you very soon. And,
all right. Enjoy.
Stay well.
Enjoy.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to Diplomacy Cast. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Wasn't it fun?
It was great.
I had a great time.
Yeah, definitely. For Nathan Barnes, I'm Eric Mead. Signing off. We'll talk to you next time.
For Eric Mead, I am a giant 13-foot-tall chocolate banana.
I was just trying to sound like a radio guy. That's what I get. Bye, everyone.